Today is February 4th, and we are taping Bible in the Ancient Near East, and we are up to Roman numeral 2, Genesis narratives. This is going to be very exciting. And in your Choveret, there is a page that starts with the words, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Do you see it? From Nochum Sarna. Epic of Gilgamesh. You know what? So wait, let's.
Oh, 41 is taken.
Okay, starting with page 41, it says, "End Sarna, understanding Genesis." Okay. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh is certainly not the very first thing that you're going to run into. In terms of what we're doing with Bereishis. There are certainly creation epics that predate the flood. But we will divide our study of Bereishis into three parts. One, creation epics. Flood story, and patriarchs and matriarchs. Right? So as far as parallels in the Bereishis, creation epics, then we have flood stories, and then we'll have stories of the people who start the nation. For us, you know, the Avos and the Shvatim, brothers. Okay. We will not be going through all of Bereishis, but just you know, enough to get our feet wet from this this section. Okay, everyone should have the syllabus in front of you. We're going through basically four sources. Okay, Sarna is not a scholarly source. It's just to just give you the parallels and. All four of these assume, as I will, that you know the basic stories, right? Hashem told a hero who is more righteous than everybody else, I need you to save the world, and gives him instructions of how to do so. Okay? Okay. So, as far as the creation epics, so, I don't have characters. I just have God saying a bunch of things. But here's the basic difference. Very simple. Is that in every ancient Near Eastern parallel, because an Egyptian, Sumerian, Babylonian, all someone who lives in Akkad, they're all curious how we came here, right? Did someone fall from another planet and start to colonize? How did we get here, right? So here is the general principle, is that the Torah is the most boring of every single ancient description of creation. The end. Okay. Why do I say that? Because it's just a bunch of days and a bunch of statements, and then it comes to be. Right? The other creation epics tell you something that the Torah doesn't tell you. How all those things happened. They're certainly fantastic, by our understanding. Let's just start off. Is that a goddess and a god are having a fight over something, right? It just starts that way. We're not even sure what caused the fight, and they start to starts to get ugly, and they start to rip body parts off, right? Mike Tyson did someone's ear off. One god bites off the ear of another god and spits it across the cosmos, and the blood starts to drip and starts to spread all over the galaxy, and they become planets, and then the ear itself, the earlobe itself, stops off someplace and becomes the sun, and then they all, just to show how grand these gods are. Wow, a little piece of the earlobe, and that's our galaxy. Right? So, you see, it's just a simple difference. simple. It's one, it's two three-letter English words. The ancient epics of creation are interested in telling its readers. Someone fabricated it at some point. I reserve the right to say that mine is legitimate, right? But I also reserve the right to say that someone else would say mine is what I think of theirs. But okay, I'm a believer. All right, I'm indoctrinated. Okay, so I believe in doctrine. I'm orthodox. Get it, doctrine. So.
Do they think they're story?
I don't think they ever meant to. That's a fair question. So the question is, what does it mean if we don't take our sources literally? I'll tell you this. The Rambam takes lots of stories that are written in the Torah that appear to be a literal point. Right? The starting creation with the snake talking to a woman. Right? The Rambam says no such thing. It's just a Torah Yetzer Hara that's given metaphorical place as a snake. Alright? The Rambam and Ibn Ezra, Radak, the Sephardic Meforshim didn't mind taking these moving in this direction. And what's interesting is that the Ashkenazim were more literalists, probably because they lived amongst Christians who allegorized everything. Not just biblical stories, they allegorized mitzvahs. You don't have to actually circumcise the body, just circumcise your heart, and that's what the Torah is. So Jews living under that framework tended to look at, say a story in Hosea where a prophet is told to marry a harlot. Rashi doesn't mind that, I'm talking about the beginning of Tresor. Rashi doesn't mind that he actually did so. And Ibn Ezra and Rambam and Radak both say, Khalilah, he didn't do that. It's just a metaphor for some other kind of lust that Bnei Israel have for themselves. That's so. Okay, but back to Gracious is that look, I think Rashi engages in this also. I use this one example, but there are many. The Torah says that Reuven slept with his father's wife. It's called Pilagish, but she's also called his wife. Vayishkav Reuven es Bilha. I don't need a dictionary to tell me what those words mean, right? But Rashi tells us that he didn't do that. Rashi didn't make it up. He saw it in the Gemara Megillah. Right? It's even in the Targum. That he didn't sleep with her, that he did something else, that he moved a bed, a couch from one place to another. You're all familiar with that, because that's what you learned in third grade. Because when you probably learned that story the first time in Parshas Vayishlach, I learned it in third grade at this very school right down the block in Parshas Vayishlach. And the teacher wasn't about to tell us what Vayishkav is Bilha, but I do remember her saying that, he was very jealous for his mother. He wanted his father to love his mother, and he wanted to teach his father a lesson that, your favorite wife just died, now you should. You should move in. We wink to each other. We knew what that meant. You should move in with my mother. Don't move in with Bilha, right? So this became a what does Rashi actually think happened? That's a separate question of a different course. But Rashi says things that, you can't just say Elu ve'Elu. Rivka was either 3 when she married Yitzchak, or she was 20 when she married Yitzchak. Right? So Rashi says she was 3, Rashbam says she was 20. Rashbam uses, he develops proofs from interesting sources within Chazal also. Rashi didn't mind saying that Rivka was old, 3 years old when she married Yitzchak. Right? But then Rashi himself betrays his opinion later at the end of the Parsha, where he seems to indicate that she's quite a bit older also. So, I'm just telling you, Pashner, just to answer your question. Did the ancient Akkadian really believe that that's how the planets came to be? Were there orthodox Akkadians who said, you have to stick strictly to the... I don't have them around long enough to answer that question. But it's an important question for us. Right? Let us, there's no tenet of faith of the Rambam, Ani Mami Bezu Neshlema, that I have to take every biblical account literally. Look, you have those on the opposite end of the scheme who say that you have to take every Medrash literally, which the Rambam called foolish. Okay, so did Rashi really believe, I'm sorry for this tangent, but it's so crucial, did Rashi really believe that water rose out of a well into Rivka's pail, and that's what so impressed Avram's servant to run after her, and only go straight to her to ask her for water without giving any other girl a chance that day? He said, the first girl that gives me water at my camel. So why did he scream out, anybody have water for a thirsty stranger? And see, which girl gives him first food for his camels also? Why did he run straight to her? Right? So Rashi says, the water rose out of the well into a pail. Knowing the Radak and the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra, even if the Pasuk said, and he saw water rise out of the well into her pail, in the Pasuk I'm saying, so he ran over to her and said, this must be a special girl. Right? Even if such a pasuk appeared, Ibn Ezra would say, I don't think this is really what happened. I think what the Torah is telling us is some kind of deeper explanation that he saw in her a miraculous connection. He was able to maybe some of you have discerned this in Yitz Hashem. On the first date, you say, huh, this is miraculous. You got everything I'm looking for. And she likes me. And everything I'm looking for, she's got. That's miraculous, right? How often does that happen on a blind date, right? So that's what it means. It's something deeper, that he saw something miraculous in her. Right? Ibn Ezra would say something like that, even if the pasuk said that water rose up. Right? Well, look, these are different ways to read the text. Okay, back to us. The ancient Sumerian wants to know how the world was created.
Okay, let's continue, guys. All right, so we are... Finally, we moved from the creation epics to flood epics, and that's what you have here on in two different places. You have Sarna, right? Sarna, we're doing the flood epic as well as Migdal Bavel, and then you have some material from. I'll give you just a little bit from this third source, Damrash, and here's the basic thrust. Is that the Torah tells the story of a cataclysmic flood that destroys all of life, mankind as well as animals. There's a discussion at the end of Masechet Zvachim whether fish were killed also, whether the water was hot and extended to the deep. But okay, the Torah never tells us that if this encompassed the entire world, but the entire mankind. Now, mankind was just a small area at that time. So, but it says Kol Ha'ikum, everything that rose up and walked on its own was destroyed by this. So, you should know that practically every ancient civilization, from Chomite societies to Yefet societies, and certainly most of all, Semitic societies, have flood stories. This has spread up to Europe, it's spread down to Africa. They were aware of a devastating flood that wiped out an entire civilization. Now, if you want to, you want to move from what you said about creation on this score, could an asteroid that hits the Mediterranean make a tsunami that takes the Mediterranean and wipes out the whole of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and everything else that where a man lived at the time. I'll tell you, there is a commentary that you're probably all familiar with, who actually seeks to explain difficult stories in the Bible this way. Is the Netziv. Netziv says that what took out Sodom was a comet or an asteroid, a small asteroid. Right? And he uses it to just explain how the certain psukim. No one can accuse the Tziv of being a a nuanced. He was. I'll tell you, he was. Get off on all these tangents about Rashi, but then you should know that the Tziv was a great mechadesh of parshanut in his time. To the point that he's not really studied in the Bate Midrashos today in Ponovich and Mir, because he was so the Hamek Dover. I'm sure you're familiar with it, right? So, the ancient epics describing these flood stories. Let's maybe just read a little bit of Sarna now. You see on page 41 when it says Epic of Gilgamesh, right? Most famous, most detailed, and most complete of all the Mesopotamian flood stories is that recounted as an incident in the 11th tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh. In the course of excavations conducted between 1849 and 1854 at Nineveh, which in the 7th century served the ancient Assyrian Empire as a capital, that's where Yonah was told to go to get them to do tshuva, A copy of this epic was discovered in the library of King Ashurbanipal. He's mentioned in Tanakh. This Gilgamesh epic, like Berosus' flood story, goes back to Sumerian prototypes. Just another one of the many flood stories that were known even before then. This could have been guessed from the names of the gods and heroes, even if the Sumerian literary models of most of the episodes have not been recovered. In other words, Epic of Gilgamesh is not the first ancient flood story that we've heard, besides that's in the Torah, but it is by all means the most detailed and voluminous. And in Damrosch, you actually have, it tells you the stories, right? And basically what all the stories have in common is on one side something profoundly different than the Torah's code. And it's right there, it's just amazing. And I take it to you from a Kli Yokar. Let me see if you can darshan with me. I did today Rashi, Nitziv, now Kli Yokar. I'm not going to do this all the time. Torah says that if you... It talks about abusing orphans and widows and strangers. Right? And it says, after describing them in the previous pasuk, it says, Im anei ta'aneoso. Right? Im tsa'ok yitz'akelai. Right? That's about enough words right there. Shemoa eshma, I will listen. Right? It gets gruesome afterwards. I will make your wives almanos. I will make your children yisomim if you don't pay attention to their needs. Right? So the Kli Yokar comments on this is the first time this kind of lashon happens in Parshas Mishpat. It's this week's Parsha. Right? What's all this double lashonos here? If you afflict him, if you cry and cry out to him, what is that? I know we have it a lot in the Torah, Shema. Shavayim, Shemoa Tishma'u, you know, Shacholach Hashkach. It's Hashav Tishibay, Mocheach Tochiach. They can give 100 of these. If you know, in the second paragraph of Bamatzia, the Gemara itself gives about 30 drushes of these double Lushonos, one after the other. Like Hashav Tishibay, if someone loses an article on Monday and you return it at great, great effort, and then he loses it again on Tuesday and you find it. What a. You return it again, and then he loses it again. This guy is not watching his stuff. Why should I care about his good? His articles more than he does. Hoshev Tishivain teaches return it and return it and keep returning it. Hocheach Tochiach, you rebuke someone, and he does the same thing again. Keep rebuking him until you're sure he's not going to listen. How do you know? Hocheach Tochiach. Taking a second out. In each one of these cases, you have Rabbi Yishmael, or a student of his saint. That's just Dibra Torah Kadoshon B'nei Adam. There's nothing to be derived from the sexual Lashon. If I agree that you have to return it again, I get it from some other ugly. But not from this double Lashon. After all, how many times can someone die? Because it says, most you must. So Rabbi Akiva, who likes these drushes, says, yeah, he dies in this world, and he dies in the next world. He doesn't have Olam HaBa. Right? Okay, but anyway, that's the Machlokas. So why do we have all these double Lashonos? So the Kli Yokar says something amazing. And this goes down to these flood epics. But first, this question is not only why do you have all these double lashonos? The question is this. Why is that a problem? Parshanut problem. Explain to me. I know this is not a parshanut class, but still. Why is that a problem? The pasuk before said, don't abuse the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. It should be otam. Why is it oto? So the Kli Yokar says, three of these. Now, the Drash, you have to know the Kli Yokar. You're familiar with him, Ephraim Lipshitz, 17th century. Everything he writes is a homily. It's a beautiful Drash. And you see, the great story is just amazing. He says, the Oso is... Come on, hit me. The Oso, who's it going?
You.
Imane Ta'ane Oso. You abuse these people. Why this should be Osam?
God.
It's God. You're abusing God if you don't take care of these people. Now, God. Because what might a cynic look at when he sees a poor widow and an orphan?
God already.
You did it, God.
Yeah.
You take care of them. You took them, the father, right? Whether he died because of a drowning accident or because he was struck by lightning or the hunter hit him. I don't know. You took him, so you take care of them. It's not my problem, right? So Hashem says, if you start to behave that way, just recognize you're hurting the person and you're hurting me. Right? The Oso is God. That's the Kliok. Okay? This is how Judaism differentiates itself. This is how the early Torah differentiates itself from all these ancient epics. It's amazing. If you read all these flood stories, the most famous one is the Epic of Gilgamesh. You will see something amazing emerges. It's that the Torah's description of the ancient flood is the only one, and there are many, many others. Okay, Sarnagit doesn't give you the whole thing out, he just gives you senses. But Damrosh gives you the whole story, it's out in front of you in your Choberet. It's the only one in which there is a morality issue at hand. In every ancient epic, it's amazing. What do they think they're getting away with? Because that's how the ancient Sumerian viewed religion. You are on this earth to serve a god who is much more powerful than you, and the purpose of serving him or her or them is to gain security against your next battle, to make the crops grow. You have to find which god you have to serve for that purpose. And you know what happens? It's very easy to explain bad things, because if your crops don't grow, it could be because the goddess of the crops, usually a fertility goddess, is being blocked by another god who's upset with her for some reason. She hasn't given herself over to a certain god, so we say, you know what? I'm blocking all your prayers. Your prayers can't reach you. Right? So an ancient Egyptian... But a woman is infertile, she says, she can explain it. She can say, oh, other gods, please let the goddess of fertility hear my prayers and grant me what I want. Right? So you worship your god not for morality. Heck, the gods themselves are not moral. Look at the ancients write about their own gods. They're certainly not more of our standards. Right? I think I've told you this already. They steal from each other. And they're very vindictive about man, right? They just like to have fun and just, you know, let's not go. Oh, yeah, it's time for a flood there. Look, a cynic can look at, you know, a lot of things that happen and say, you know, Hashem, where are you? How did you make that happen? What was that flood for? Right? We say for Eo and learn how we deal with these things. We learn Kohelis and see how we deal with these things. Prophets were not mute about these things, right? But here's the issue: in the epic, especially let's do the Epic of Gilgamesh specifically. He builds his ark that saves mankind. Get this: in spite of the gods, he's not told by the gods to do this. The flood isn't coming because man has become immoral or violent. The flood is coming because man is getting too much of the cosmic pie. Man is overstepping himself. Right? Ancient flood is happening, and floods are happening because I'm doing this to the gods want all of mankind destroyed. And we'll start all over. Right? Because I'll also admit that Hashem, and familiar with Midrashim, Rabbi Abahu, and Midrashim, and Bar Rambo, says that many worlds were created. Get it? Whether that means that this world is in its 17th time around, or whether there are many other worlds out there. Who cares? They're both fine with me. Right? So that's what they were hoping to do, the gods. Let's just get rid of all mankind. And look at this guy, Gilgamesh, look what he did. He managed to flout us. How did he get that? Wow. He knew some secrets. And then he becomes a god himself as a result of this heroism. Yes?
But isn't the story in the Torah also man overstepping themselves, but in a different way?
Yes.
Overstepping themselves.
Yes, absolutely. But at least there is a morality issue in it. At least there's, you know, there's a... And when the day is done, you can say, I know In both stories, there's a reason given for the destruction, right? So all these stories definitely point to a specific event that took place. I just described. The Netziv says what he says about Sodom. He does not say that about the flood, by the way. I'm just saying that, you know, giving an example of something that could have done that to a whole, you know, whole area of North Africa, Mesopotamia, and Canaan, and that where people could have either not experienced it themselves or heard stories from previous generations, right? That's what they might have experienced. So here is the your klal gadol is that the ancient descriptions of these voracious events will not have a moral aspect to them. The flood story is an easy one. I'm now giving a segue to our next class. Flood story is easy. It's so obvious that there's a difference. It says, Chamas Hashem Chapeyem, God says, I created man, hopefully with X, Y, Z in mind. Obviously, there's an aspect of free will. Rashi discusses God's omniscience. How did God not know that this would happen if he knows all things? And Rashi discusses maybe conversations he had with heretics or conversations that he quotes from Midrashim about people who deal with this issue. At the very last Rashi in Parshas Bereishis that deals with this. The segue is that it's going to be a little more difficult when we read about Migdal Bavel parallels, which is what we're going to do next class. That's what I'm going to ask you to do. Is just read the 9 psukim of the Migdal Bavel story. Right? Please make sure to email the wolf pages to me at that you did. Okay. Email the wolf, the pages from this book. That you were supposed to take one phrase or word from this. It's in your chaveret. If you have it now, sure. So 9 psukim, chapter 11 of Bereishis, Perek Yud Aleph of Sefer Bereishis. The first 9 psukim is the story of Migdal Bavel. Perek Yud Aleph. And so this is interesting. Two interesting points. One is that there are very many ancient parallels to also a number of ancient parallels to these this man's ascension to some high point and being knocked off his pedestal. But what's very interesting on the flip side of that is that while there are notably in Sefer Yeshayahu, but there are a few places in Tanakh where the Nevi'im were aware of the flood, right? Noah has a hakot, right? Which talks about the flood, right? But Migdal Bavel has no hint whatsoever in the entire rest of Tanakh. No one makes reference to there's certainly references to haughtiness and taking man down a peg, because of haughtiness, but no specific reference to Migdal Bavel. All right, that's not. Migdal Bavel is only 9 psukim after all. The flood takes up 4 chapters, 6, 7, 8, 9. So that there's a lot of stuff there, right? So next class we're going to discuss the flood, the Migdal Bavel, which Sarna has lots of stuff to say about the Epic of Gilgamesh also. In Sarna, on page 63, is the Tower of Babel, which is what we're going to do next class. So here's what you need to do. You have to bring in the Bereishis, right? You have to have a Tanakh, right? Full Tanakh, right? It'll be a Chumash, but we're doing Bereishis, right? Just bring in any Tanakh, no Mefarshim necessary, and we will learn the Tower of Babel, Mitzvah Hashem, next class, okay? And that will be mostly with Sarna, Nachum Sarna. You have the pages there. Okay, page 63 is. Okay. Have a great day, everyone. Will you not have me?